So Sherida, I thought with most of the chairs, we're just starting with basic background of how you found your way into preservation, because all the chairs have come at it with various backgrounds, although you and Jean have the architecture background.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering how you got engaged in preservation, if you can talk about your educational experience as an architect and as an educator, and how all of that played into your interest and awareness of preservation.
That's a good question. Most people ask me why, because you grew up in California and there's nothing worth saving, which is not true. And you came to New York. Now, I think I have always had a real passion for the city as a form, and whether it's an American city or a European city, the layering of building types really, to me, tells the story of a people and a place. And it's really the storytelling that first engaged me. And then as an architect, you, working in New York City for 30 years, it's really something you have to grapple with, because there are not many clean sites. There's always something. So when I look north at Worldwide Plaza, which was one of the first really big projects that I did in the city, we were building on the site of the old Madison Square Garden. Not the McKinley-White one, but the one that people remembered the elephants and everything else. And so as excavation proceeded, I mean, they weren't saving it because the building had been knocked down so many years before. But there were a lot of interesting layers of archaeology, if you want to call it, that were there. And so people would reminisce about the elephants and the circus and the, you know, the sporting events and
right.
all those things. So that was, again, it was part of a story. And then when we worked on a project at 86th and Lexington, which was the Upper East Side Gimbel's store, and we did a whole renovation to convert that into condominiums and add more floors. Again, it was learning to deal with an existing structure, and it was going to be completely reclad, but we had to go through a whole history because of the regulatory history. So it's sort of coming at it from my love of history and then architecturally just being a problem solver. And I think it's that problem solving aspect that both attracted the people, appointing people to the commission, to me, and my interest in being on the commission, which I saw as a huge way to address, you know, in the mid-90s, the need to really think about what directions the city was going to go. Because at that point, you know, early in Giuliani time,
right,
things were still a little rough around the edges. So it was really fun. And coming from California, I mean, I lived near San Francisco, and I went to Berkeley, and then I lived in L.A. for graduate school. And despite what people think, there are really some great buildings, both mostly 20th century, but that also was important to dealing with a lot of the things that we were dealing with at Landmarks in terms of 20th century buildings.
Yeah, I'm very interested in your perceptions on modernism in particular, which
I can be the good guy or the bad guy.
So you mentioned, you know, that the your interest in history and storytelling and problem solving were what attracted people to appointing you to the commission in the first place. Could you talk a bit more about how your approach to join the commission, what you were doing at the time?
Easily. It was actually very funny, because I was leaving SOM in November, October of 93. And I was at a meeting with the leaders of the real estate board. This is how out of left field this is. And I told them that we didn't even know who was going to win the mayoral election. And I said to them, because I knew that they were powerful people and city government. I said, look, if there are any opportunities for me to serve in city government, I'd really love to do that. You know, I've done a lot in architecture. I was a design associate at SOM. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed what I was doing, but I felt like, I mean, I've always been attracted to public service, and I thought it was a good moment because I had sort of gathered enough experience to be useful in some way. And so they put my name in to the interview committee after Giuliani was elected, and I was interviewed by his, I don't remember what they even call it, the interview committee. And I had been sort of promoted to them as somebody who could be like a good executive director at city planning. And I went in for my interview, and the head of the real estate board called me the next morning, and he said, they loved you. They think you should be chairman of city planning. And I said, no. I think that would be a big mistake. I would love to do it, but I didn't feel that I had the expertise or the gravitas to really tell all the developers in the city and all the other things that city planning does. I really didn't feel that that was an appropriate role for me. So they said, okay. It was really interesting because, Joe Rose was going to get that position, I think, from day one. But apparently that wasn't clear to everybody else. I didn't know it. And I just was so flabbergasted that anybody was going to recommend me to do that position. I just said, I think that's a little bit of a stretch. And so a few months later, it was the real estate board. I had been working with them on a design committee looking at different zoning proposals, and that's why they thought I had some sense. And they then called up and said, there's an opening on the Landmarks Commission for a Bronx resident. And I lived in the Bronx at that point. And they said, would you be interested in that? And I said, absolutely, because I had only heard how bad it was to go before the Landmarks Commission. I mean, every architect hated going there. And the neighborhood groups were upset all the time. So it just seemed like it was an interesting place to go. And it should, to me, if you're reviewing architectural plans, it should be about architecture in some way, shape, or form. And so I met with the interview committee again, a new group, and they all said, very nice. And at that point, Jennifer Rapp had not been announced. And so she was nominated as chair of the commission that summer, and I met with her because she didn't want to have somebody that she hadn't spoken to and didn't know.
Had she been nominated at that point?
She was probably in the background check phase because she took office the fall of 94, I think, or so. Late summer. And then I went, my appointment hearings were humorous. I went to my appointment hearing in February of 95. I was 8.5 months pregnant, and the mayor, being Rudy, had not bothered to consult with the Bronx delegation about the person he was nominating as the Bronx commissioner for Landmarks. And so when I got to the hearing,
had not met with which, the Bronx delegation within his office?
The city council.
Oh.
And since they do get to approve you, that was a problem.
So he basically, his committee had decided to appoint, to nominate
he
you.
And Jennifer and her counsel, I had gone through everything. I had done the background checks from City Hall. I had done the background checks at the City Council. I had met with all the investigators. I had passed all my, things that I needed to pass. But the Bronx delegation and this was, you know, the city council and Rudy Giuliani always were like at loggerheads in a lot of ways. So this was one thing they could do, is say, we're not going to take action on this nomination. Mm-hmm. Until we've had a chance to meet with her. And fortunately, the delegation members were actually, I mean, one of the key people was my own council member, and who was not exactly in favor of me taking the position, because the reason I lived in the Bronx at that time was my husband was in medical school at Einstein. And so, long story short, they saw how pregnant I was, and one of them took pity and said, we'll meet with you right after we've closed the hearing. I said, fine. So I met with them. Everything was, you know, happy and positive. Mm-hmm. And they said, we don't know if we're going to have another appointments hearing next month, but we'll bring you back as soon as the schedule allows. So that was February. And I think I went back in April.
Of 2005.
Of 1995.
Oh, 1995.
And was appointed.
And so that was your first, that first session was your first interaction with Giuliani? Or had you had interactions with him before?
I had no interaction with Rudy Giuliani at all. I met with a deputy mayor, mm-hmm. who sort of, the one that the Landmarks Commissioner appointed to, mm-hmm. which at that point was Randy Mastro, and I met with him. He and I had met through the real estate board before that, so he kind of knew me and I kind of knew him, and so that was okay. I never met with Rudy until much later, and they, so they appointed me.
So you have such an interesting background by being the architect and having the hands-on skills, being able to read drawings.
Yes, that helped a lot.
So valuable. Being able to talk about contextualism, having worked in the field, having done work with zoning, with the real estate board, and having that sense of things. How do you think that combination of skills really helped you as a commissioner to understand urbanism and to understand these layers and to think through that?
I understood process. Both the regulatory process. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't understand all the landmark side of it until I was actually at the commission, but I understood the city planning process because almost everything I had worked on was either a BSA case, which required a lot of interaction, or it was a special permit from city planning. So I knew the process.
Uh-huh.
And the other part of it was really being a real problem. I mean, most architects are trained in what, you know, some people call design thinking. Design thinking is really all about, these are all the things on the table.
Yeah.
How do you prioritize? How do you make decisions about what you're going to do? And so my very first hearing, I'll never forget this, there was an application for a new storefront for, it was a skiing, sort of a ski wear store that wanted to go into a building on Madison Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
And they had proposed something. And people were just saying, I like it or I don't like it. So I thought, this is really like, what I'm hearing around the table are such little things. There's got to be a way to put this together and come up with a solution. So I didn't say I liked it or I didn't like it. I said, well, this is really good, except could you do this and could you do this? You know, consultation with their clients amongst
right.
them, and then they said, yes, we can do that. And so it got approved. Mm-hmm. Instead of, well, we need to do this and we need to do that, they came, they got approved, and it was done. And what I was told afterwards that some of the commissioners who had been there for a while mm-hmm. said, she's going to be good. she actually can get the resolutions. And that was how I always took my role on the commission, to get to answers. Because whether you're an applicant or you're an advocate, I think it's just terrible to leave everybody hanging. Mm-hmm. This is a public.
That's a very good point.
It's paid for by the taxpayers, who are all of us. And if people are just left trying to you know, divine. What do they want?
It's just not productive.
Yeah.
And from my perspective, leaving historic buildings without purpose or use is the first step in a demolition process. Because if they're not in use, mm-hmm. they're not being taken care of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I say I'm very pragmatic.
Yeah.
And that's about the best I can say.
Well, I think that's, you know, interesting on so many levels. And one thing I'm curious about is, it sounds like communication was key for
yes.
you, that nothing was going to be vague, that you were going to help work people through this process. And I'm wondering, I know that Landmarks isn't a design review board, but it sounds like you were able to engage, or maybe you want to comment on that, but it sounds like you were really able to engage the applicants and work with them on their design, and that you were able to bring it to another level. And I'm wondering if you could talk about that, because I think a lot of people are uncertain about the role that Landmarks plays in design and how much impact it has on design.
I think Landmarks is all about design. Even for the buildings that may not be beautiful,
mm-hmm.
there are every decision that you make as a tenant, as an owner, or as an architect is about how things are going to be constructed. Because usually you're not going to a public hearing if you're just restoring what's already there. You're doing something to that building. Whether you're taking things out or you're putting new things in, there's an action that's being proposed. And putting new things in really requires some kind of design attitude. Whether you want to say you're replicating what was there before,
mm-hmm.
which is almost impossible to do. And there are a couple of good good object lessons from the commission. But mostly you're dealing with things that are gone.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of storefronts. And most of the stuff that comes to the commission is not, big fancy building projects.
Right.
It's, storefront infill, new windows, back of the building, interventions.
Mm-hmm.
And they need to have some design quality. And that, I think, Commissioner Matsuna and I were both always very consistent that this was about design.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't... Once you were before the commission, it was definitely a design decision
mm-hmm.
that had to be made. And, there were applicants who were very articulate at sort of outlining what the choices to be made were.
Mm-hmm.
You could try and replicate what had been there before.
Right.
You could interpret, based on the surrounding neighborhood, something new, but... Mm-hmm. that was kind of postmodern historic, or you could do something completely different, but it still had to be able to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a design decision, as
mm-hmm.
far as I'm concerned, whether it's the detail of it or whether
right.
it's the overall proportion of the elements. So I really believe that it is a design review process
mm-hmm.
a lot of the time.
And you believe then that the commission, by advising applicants, has the ability to shape the design and bring it to a higher level, that there's that there's a back and forth of making recommendations and whatnot.
Yes, and I remember very early in my tenure as a commissioner, Alex Herrera, who was the director of preservation at that time, came to me and he said, do we dumb designs down by trying to get all of these ideas from the community and this? And I said, it's not that you try to dumb the design down, it's
mm-hmm.
that you come up with a solution that is the least offensive to the largest number of people, and it's not necessarily the right answer.
Hmm.
Because there are a lot of projects that have an attempt to be contextual, but they're made out of thin materials with no proper detail, with crappy windows, sorry. But at the end of the day, making something that looks on a piece of paper like it fits in doesn't mean that the reality of it is going to feel like it belongs in that neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And there were a lot of things that came in like that.
Yeah.
So it was interesting.
So it sounds like also then the quality of materials and quality of construction in your mind, as an architect, I mean, could you just see this when you looked at an application? Oh. And how did that, you were bringing something that, you know, historians for the most part can't bring, that planner. How did that technical ability come into the commission and being able to read those types of details and understand?
I think
them?
That was where some applicants wanted to kill me. Because, you know, they would have, and I think the staff at that time was not as populated with people who understood the construction technology and the design thinking that went behind some types of buildings. And the staff would review and understand it as a two-dimensional paper application and may not have the full understanding. I think with Sarah Carroll and especially under Brian Hogg, whose knowledge of architecture was just extraordinary, but they and the staff that work for them are, I think, extremely knowledgeable today. And working with staff as I do now, it's really terrific because they are really understanding what is being proposed. So I think, you know, but when I first started, it was slightly different. I mean, Alex obviously has an architectural background and really understands how things go together, but how to get to either a denial or an approval that was based on something more than looking like the neighboring building, because looking like a neighboring building may not be the right answer for your building. And also, you know, there's this second layer, which is if it was worth designating these buildings and telling people they had to keep them up, then there has to be some quality that's being preserved. And why on earth would you allow somebody to put a really junky, flat, you know, facade just because it has punched windows and a red brick? It's not going to feel the same. And I think one of the really good things about the time that I was on the commission was that we did have a lot of architects. And, you know, with Vicky Matsuna and Richard Alcott and Jan Pokorny, who was the best.
Yes.
And Pablo Bengoechea, because he's an architect and a planner. We had a really extraordinary, I think, wealth of thinking available. And we were lucky because Tom Pike and Meredith Kane were two of the smartest people I met. Once, you know, they understood aesthetics and architecture in a way that a lot of lay people don't. Just by being there and being smart. And Chris Moore's another one. Just an incredible group of people. And we had a very collegial, and I think that's continued to today. Prior to Jennifer, the commissioners, I think, were more argumentative and less respectful of both applicants and each other's opinions.
How did you see that manifested?
Well, because I came on the commission afterwards, it was only in talking to commissioners who had been there for a while. And before Jennifer, the commission would start, I think, in the afternoon, and they would work till late at night, and they only got to eat, like, bad pizza, and so nobody was in a good mood. And some of the people who had been appointed in the past were particularly argumentative and critical. You know, they took what they used to do to students in architecture school and did it to professionals in the field.
Right.
And they told me, I replaced Ulrich Franzen, and they told me that Rick Franzen used to go up and, like, mark people's drawings, their boards. And I, you can't do that. People have paid, and this is the other part, being an architect, I understand what the client is asking you to do, what the client is investing in you and what you're doing.
Right.
And even if it's a terrible proposal, you have to at least respect the fact that somebody wanted to bring it forward.
Right.
And they invested some money in this, and you owe them at least a hearing and constructive criticism.
Mm-hmm.
So, and Jennifer was 100% about that. She got the commission to behave in a much more business-like manner by starting hearings at 9:30 in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
She got a caterer to do the lunches. These are stupid things, but she got this woman who did incredible, healthy, like, wonderful lunches.
Yeah.
Just so you had good food to eat,
mm-hmm.
and it was good for you. She instituted a coffee hour break.
That's nice.
It was important. We all paid for it because, the lunch took up, I think, most of our lunch budget. But she made sure that there was a coffee break and that, if we could have a cookie or something in the afternoon.
Yeah.
That way, you could go from 9:30 in the morning till 7 at night if need be.
Right.
And she really insisted on a collegial atmosphere and treating people nicely, which is not, I think, what most people would expect, but she really, really made it possible, and she totally understood that it was about buildings. She didn't know anything about architecture. She would always say, "This isn't what I do."
Huh.
But she said, but you know it, Richard, Jan, you guys know this. You need to tell me what the right answers are, and I will fight for them if I can.
Huh.
And so it was an incredibly collegial working relationship amongst all the commissioners.
And where were most of these discussions relying on? Were these in the public hearings? That
she never said that in a public hearing.
Well, not saying that, but getting the dialogue going of hearing your voices.
Well, at that time, lunchtime was, we couldn't talk about matters that were happening in the hearing.
Mm-hmm.
But she would say that, some issue was coming up and there might be some preliminary discussion, and at that time both she and I benefited tremendously, and I think the commission benefited from the use of committees, which were not public, to meet with applicants and be able to have a very free dialogue with them beforehand. I know that it drove a lot of advocates crazy, but it was very productive.
No, and that's what I think, since advocates are going to be reading this, to hear more about the productivity of why you think they're so valuable would be great to have on the record. So I don't know if you want to say anything more about it, about what it was that those allowed you to do that you wouldn't otherwise have been able to do.
I think, in a very short sort of description, people who, either the owner or the owner and the architect,
mm-hmm.
who wanted to do something. And Jennifer had a very good sense of when something was going to be controversial, mm-hmm. or difficult. She would bring them in to meet with 3 or 4 commissioners.
Mm-hmm. As part of these committees.
In the committee. And she would give them the opportunity to make a presentation or, show some sketches.
Yeah.
And that was very productive because now I think an owner or an architect feels that they need to do a full-blown presentation of an idea and take that, and file an application,
mm-hmm.
and then go to a public hearing. Well, that's, that could be 6 months worth of work,
mm.
which
That's true.
Could be $240,000. That could be $250,000.
Yeah.
That somebody has invested in a very bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the committee session, you wouldn't get, yes, we'll approve that, or no, we won't approve that. What you would get is a conversation about, well, why do you want to do it this way? And maybe you should think about doing something either in this direction or in this direction. We never told people what to do,
mm-hmm.
and we never told them, you're going to get something approved, because we were only three or four people.
Right.
So, and there were times when the committee was completely off base about a project, when it had political, really big political highlights to it. But it really, I think, was a very practical way of dealing with the very early time in a project, because to invest the money into something that is just going to get knocked down
right.
at the first hearing is really crazy. And some of these projects are so small that it doesn't make sense to even advance it. And I know that they have ways of, you know, showing things to people, but that initial back and forth with an applicant was really important. And the project that was the most interesting with that, and, you know, most successful at a hearing and has caused some people heartburn afterwards, was Hearst. I mean, Hearst was entirely done through a committee. We never knew if we were going to get to yes.
Mm-hmm.
But we knew that all the issues had been put on the table.
Can I ask a bit more about the committees themselves?
Mm-hmm.
How many committees were they?
There were.
What was the composition?
Well, there
how
were
did they work?
There were two standing committees.
Mm-hmm.
One was the designation committee.
Gotcha.
And one was the policy committee. And the designation committee was a group of five commissioners. It couldn't be six, so I think it was five. One was the chairman, and then there were four others. I did not become a member of the designation committee until I became chairman. And there was a formal process for reviewing potential designations, and the designation committee had to say, we think it's of interest. It wasn't a designation, but that would lead to a letter from the commission to the building owner saying, we think you might have something of value. And then the process could start.
So just so I make sure I get it. So the applicant submits the application to LPC, and then the designation committee would decide whether it merited a certain amount of
it was review. Even more complicated because somebody, you know, requests for evaluation, the RFEs,
mm-hmm.
could come from anywhere. It could come from a building owner. It could come from an advocacy group. It could come from a member of the commission. It could come from staff. It could come from anywhere. All you had to do was say, I'm interested. Will you look at this? And the first step was an internal committee that was made up of the chief of staff, the executive director, the head of the research department, and there was another member of the research department, the chair, and the council.
Mm-hmm.
So it was entirely internal.
Huh.
And that group would look at whatever that building or place was
right.
and say, does it meet the criteria? Is it 30 years old?
Mm-hmm.
Is it, you know, whatever? Is it, is it distinctive for its place or style? Is it this? Is it that? And the research department had been led by Marjorie Pearson for a long time,
mm-hmm.
when I was first appointed to the commission. And Marjorie had real, you know, internal criteria that were applied across the board.
Mm-hmm.
And they were clearly a continuation of things that the commission had looked at before. And it was really quite strict.
Hmm.
Because if...
Strict in what sense?
Well, just because there was a neighborhood that neighbors felt was a special place.
Yeah.
It may be so completely altered that you're dealing with nothing but a bunch of buildings that are really, really not original fabric, mm-hmm. and not substantial historic fabric. It's really kind of trying to make your own special district so you can control what's going on. And that was hard to say was a historic district. And that really put a lot of neighborhoods, I think, out of contention for a lot of the evaluations.
Mm-hmm.
The individual landmarks were in some ways more problematic because you could have, you know, a really old wooden house, which you get in Staten Island a lot. It would have a lot of original fabric, but it would be in terrible condition. And so you were left saying, what do we do with it once we designate it?
Right.
Because unlike a lot of commissions, there's no money. You know, there may be grants available through the grant program, but even that was pretty slim pickings.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd have to go to the Conservancy, and they're going to make you match whatever. So there was always this sort of, what are we doing kind of aspect to individuals. But I think I opened the door to consideration of more cultural kinds of designations with Sugar Hill, because, you know, not being a historian and not being an architectural historian, I had to say, because, you know, the research staff would come back and say, well, we can do these five buildings and these five buildings and these five buildings. And then I would say, you know, if I go walk around the Upper West Side, which is a humongous historic district.
Yes.
And a lot of these buildings were in pretty altered states, or not in the best of shape when the Upper West Side district was designated. I said, and now I go to Sugar Hill.
Yes.
And I'm going up to a neighborhood that's not in great shape, but it has a feel, and it has a lot of buildings that look the way the Upper West Side looked in 1980.
Oh, that's an interesting
And
comment.
So I felt that we could draw the boundaries more expansively.
Uh-huh.
Not as generously as the neighborhood advocates wanted it, but I felt that we could do something that encompassed what could truly be revived and turned around.
Huh.
And so I think, I'm very proud of that designation, which was very tough to do, because I think we were able to respond to a community who desperately wanted something recognized there. And it allowed for consideration of a lot of the neighborhoods in Brooklyn that really did merit consideration, but had been shut out for a long time because they didn't have cohesive, you know, or original fabric throughout. But they were still recognizable as districts. The one that I felt the sorriest about was the one, Richmond Hill, which is, I mean, it's a sad, sad situation because that's such a committed group of people. And the homeowners who have renovated their buildings have done terrific jobs. But, I mean, I took the whole designation committee out there.
Yeah.
And I said, you tell me. And they just looked at me and said, this is not a historic district.
What were their reasons? I know that's just one that people talk about a lot.
There wasn't a cohesive place.
Mm-hmm.
There were very attractive buildings, maybe two on this block and one on this block and one on that block, that the advocates were owners and had done restoration for. But the rest of the place was really hodgepodge.
Huh.
And there was no streetscape. I mean, when you do a historic district, you're doing the buildings, the sidewalks, the streets. And it was just didn't hang together. And nobody, if one commissioner had said to me, I mean, that's always my joke, is that all you really need are three commissioners, because you need someone to make the motion and someone to second. because you don't have to calendar something at a full meeting of
that's,
the commission.
That's a good point.
All you need are three people who will say, I'll vote for this.
We'll hear it.
Yeah, and there was just nothing there. I'll never forget one of the commissioners walking around going, this is not a historic district. There's nothing here.
How did you see that the difference between Sugar Hill, where you described this sense of place, and then the lack of sense of place in Richmond? Could you kind of describe what it
was?
Oh,
yeah. In Sugar Hill, you had buildings that still looked like row houses, mansions, whatever they were, stables. There were buildings there that made up a real urban fabric. Mm. Richmond Hill was some renovated single-family homes and some single-family homes that had been turned into sixplexes, as far as I could see. And the thing is, it was so obvious. There were, windows were gone. Siding was on half the buildings.
Yeah.
The yards were not coherent in their form or their materials. It was just totally confused imagery was one of my favorite terms. It was great. I had a very big preservation project in White Plains, and the preservationist working on the project wrote this sentence, and these are areas of confused imagery. That is the term to use. And the thing is, when you look at Richmond Hill and you compare it to Ditmas Park or some of the more recent ones in Brooklyn, I'm blanking on the name of it, where even though there have been changes, you still have the building, the porch, the yard. And yes, the windows had been knocked out, but the building still looked like the building. And you didn't have that in Richmond Hill. It was really a mishmash. And then you could go to someplace like the Grand Concourse, which staff had resisted for a long time. And the reason they resisted, and they resisted, not for historical or planning reasons, but because from a regulatory viewpoint, there are no original windows in any of those buildings. And they said, what are we going to do?
That's interesting that the regulatory view came into play.
Well, it does. I mean, Jackson Heights had been designated before I was appointed to the commission. And the staff said, many times when projects came in, they said, you do realize we did not recommend making this a historic district because we did not think we could regulate it.
In what sense? What particular were there regulatory concerns?
They had buildings with no original windows. They had buildings that had major modifications along the sidewalk and the streetscape, and that's where all the violations came in.
Yeah.
I mean, it was really heartbreaking because, as an architect, Jackson Heights and Sunnyside Gardens are really preeminent models for development. They had really cohesive architecture, really interesting history, and really true sense of place.
Mm.
But for the staff, they were nightmares. And they were nightmares for probably 15 years. And the council member from Jackson Heights, I remember when I was chairman, said that she could not see how the commission could keep designating things because they couldn't enforce things like Jackson Heights.
Huh.
And it really was hard to do.
How did those regulatory challenges play out? I mean, one thing I'm curious about is, having recently walked around Soho and looked at Soho from this eyes of, okay, what was Soho like when the commission designated?
Mm-hmm.
And it's not like Soho is now. And in a way, because the commission had the power to regulate, Soho has more probably compatible fabric. I mean, the place we know feels more cohesive architecturally than it did at designation. So I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that and how that factors into your decisions. If it does in a place like, Sugar Hill, if you saw that potential of, we can designate this, we can regulate this, and that same phenomenon is going to happen,
someone's going to make an application to replace their cornice, and then that, then you're going to have a whole intact row at some point, you know, 10 years down the line. But I'm wondering if that was a thought consideration for the commission.
I think we just felt that if we designated something, we had to be partners with whoever owned these buildings. It couldn't be an adversarial relationship, because we would never be able to regulate. And I think that was part of the problem in a place like Jackson Heights. That community did not want to be designated. They saw it as an intrusion into the way that the community was evolving.
Yeah.
And they, you know, there was a small group of people and very good advocates for designation in Queens, the very strong historic support, but it wasn't the residents and the business people in the neighborhood. And I think that was something that we worked very hard on, you know, both under Jennifer and then under me, and I know that Bob Tierney's done a good job of this, is really getting people to buy in to the designations, because just doing it over their objections is really tough.
That's what I'm curious, because I was reading when you went to Fieldston, which is long before it was actually designated, of going to talk to owners up there. But if I can just jump back to your commissioner from 95 to 2001, before you were appointed chair.
Right.
So Jennifer Rabb went over to Hunter, and 6 months left of Giuliani's administration. You were vice chair at that
point. I was never vice chair. Pablo has been the vice chair all along.
I'm sorry for
yes. Pablo said he was someplace and they said, well, you're just going to be the chairman now. And he said, am I? And I said, I don't know.
So you weren't vice chair.
No.
How did the appointment then to commissioner come about?
She had been interested in an educational career appointment, and she had asked me if she was awarded or given the job of the presidency of Hunter, would I be interested in being the chairman? And I said, of course. And so once her appointment was confirmed, which was a whole other story from her side, she then introduced me to the deputy mayor, and he then had me meet with Mayor Giuliani, and then I was just appointed, because we managed to sidestep going to the council.
May I ask how so? Or
because the law allows the mayor to appoint any member of the commission as the chairman.
Aha.
And since I was already a commissioner,
right,
I was just appointed as the chairman. It's the Historic Districts Council likes to say I was an acting chairman. I was not. I was fully appointed.
For the record.
I was fully appointed. Not acting. You know, and I did it with the knowledge that I may not be the chairman come January 1st. This was May of 2001, and I didn't know who the next mayor was going to be.
Right. And no one did.
No one did. It was a little chaotic at that time. And so I got appointed.
What were your thoughts? You'd been a commissioner, you had seen the way Jennifer ran the commission, and you knew you were coming in. You had 6 months, maybe more, I'm assuming was kind of what's running through your head. So what were your thoughts on how you envisioned your role as chair? Did you see it in that 6 months being different than Jennifer's, being a continuation in some ways?
Well, it was going to be different. Jennifer had been a member of the Giuliani inner circle. I was not a member of the Giuliani inner circle. I really felt that I was going to be a more hands-on manager of the commission, and I was going to, I don't want to say lead the commission, but I was going to be more involved in the decision-making about the projects for new buildings, et cetera, that were coming before the commission. And it was a time when we had a lot of major projects brewing.
Mm.
We were looking at Hearst.
Mm.
That was coming. The Morgan Library was coming.
Mm-hmm.
The Whitney Museum still thought that they were going to do something on Madison Avenue.
Oh, I didn't realize
that. Oh, this is the backstory. Yeah, we really want the Whitney Museum.
I didn't even know that.
Oh, yes. It was actually the biggest one. So there were those three brewing.
Mm-hmm. When you were appointed chair.
When I was appointed chair. And then the other part of it was I really felt that the designations had Jennifer had set up a sort of, because she's a very good manager, she had set up goals for the research staff mm-hmm. each year. You know, you're going to do this many individual landmarks and this many historic districts. And knowing that we had, you know, the limited staff and the limited
right.
budget that we had, and that there was this real desire to get Sugar Hill done, I said that I felt we could shift and we could do a larger historic district and less individual landmarks and still come out whole. You know, at the end of the year. So
whole meaning having met these
we would meet the
expectations.
Goal. Yeah.
Huh.
So it was really that, and really focusing on the mid 20th century buildings that were sort of lingering, you know, in the background. We had done probably the most significant landmarks. Designations for the mid-20th century office towers. The most important ones had been done by that point.
The but, individual landmarks.
Yeah, but the you know, the Bob Stern wish list, which everybody likes to say, oh, these are, you know, some of those buildings were never going to get designated, but some of them truly merited it, and we needed to really look outside the Manhattan core. This was not... Jennifer didn't have a really big agenda for the five borough approach,
mm-hmm.
but I started by saying, I think, you know, we should look to find something in each of the boroughs, whatever it is, whether it's a district, whether it's a building, we should try to make it around the city.
Huh.
I was not as successful at that as I would have liked, but at least we looked.
Yeah. Do you feel you're also, by looking, kind of set the pieces of what happened later?
I think I at least... Well, what I think I did do is by asking Mary Beth and the research staff to sort of give me their top priorities in certain categories. Industrial buildings in Long Island City.
Huh.
The Catholic Church, I went to the research staff and I said, give me the best 25.
Wow. It's a great foresight.
And let's try to, I mean, nobody can make any inroads with the church, but if we could get a meeting, if we could get some conversation going, let's go in there and say, these are your best buildings, give them to us.
Yeah.
And maybe they won't give us any, but at least we have a shot. And, you know, at having a conversation, and we might get one. But it just seemed like it was important to strategize. And this is, I'm a big picture person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not the world's greatest manager, and I'm not a great politician. But I am strategic, and I do understand how a lot of different pieces fit together. And I felt like if I could just sort of say, okay, let's look at these specific things. Industrial buildings, mid-20th century, and this is a long shot, but the Catholic Church.
Yeah.
Let's see what we can do with these. And let's... We know that there's so much interest in historic districts outside of the Manhattan core.
Right.
Let's look at the boroughs and see what can we do. Is there something that we can at least push a little bit further? So, I mean, I had gotten the Grand Concourse signed off by the designation committee, and I thought we were going to be able to get that moving. And mm-hmm. there were just too many other things in the way. But it was there.
Yeah.
And nothing much was changed in the designation.
So was that your, within, in terms of your relationship with various staff, with the research department, which was Mary Beth Betts at that point, it was more your idea, industrial, Catholic Church.
Just setting an agenda.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's...
You set the agenda, and then she and the research staff went out and
Because that was what they do with any chairman, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, there are so many things that you could put on a designation list, and you could either have a chronological sort of calendar of things and just review, you know, do a checklist, or where are we this, where are we this, where are we this, and go along the list. Or you can actually say, okay, I would like to do this.
Yeah.
And that was like the only executive motion that you could take. And that's, I mean, my impression is that that is how priorities have been set, either from City Hall or the chairman of the commission. That's how designation priorities get set, unless, of course, there's a real demolition threat.
So you feel it's either the chair as the chair, or that there can be the City Hall influence of...
Yeah, if there's an interest.
There's one great quote that you said that I came across, and it's when you came on, and I'm just going to read this, because you say, it doesn't matter what's happening at the administration level, we're a consumer agency.
Yes.
And I thought that was such an interesting quote of definitive defining.
Well, you did read my interview then. No, but it's true.
Well, yeah, could you kind of talk about that? Because I think there's always, from a preservation fit, there's always this, is there a collusion between LBC? So can you talk about this as chair? I mean, what was the relationship to the administration? I mean, you've pretty much said that you were setting the agenda, and you were there under two mayoral mayors, Giuliani and then Bloomberg. Was there a difference between the two of them, or...?
Yes. More... Not in the day-to-day working of the commission, because I think both Giuliani and Bloomberg had real respect for the responsibilities of the city agencies. And neither one of them would call you up and say, don't do this or do this.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the only... Sidebar. Yeah. The only thing I was told I had to do was move the commission.
Oh, right.
Out of Old Slip into the municipal building. Well, I didn't have to move into the municipal building, but that's a different part of it. No, that was really... Yeah, Landmarks, I hate to say, is not the biggest or the most important to their political well-being. It's a thing. It's mm-hmm. over here, and it's important to people who care about buildings and other, you know, historical events, but it's not up here the way sanitation can be.
We've learned.
We have learned. So, I mean, what was different? Under Rudy Giuliani, he did these meetings in every community board every month. So it was a rotation around the city. And the way that he did it was he came, the deputy mayors came, and every commissioner came. And you sat at the front of this room, and people could come and ask anything they wanted.
Huh.
And Rudy, he was extremely good on his feet, and he could immediately say, you know, Sherida, you answer this question, or Ronnie, you answer this question. And there was immediate response to people.
Wow.
And that was an incredibly powerful outreach mechanism, and I think it's one of the reasons that the outer boroughs and probably the middle class New Yorkers felt that Rudy Giuliani was listening to them. He was there. Whereas the Bloomberg approach was, if he was going to go to a neighborhood, they were called town halls.
Mm-hmm.
If he was going to do a town hall, he only brought the people that he thought were going to respond to matters of interest to that community.
Huh.
Which, you know, you never know what you're going to hear.
Yeah.
Somebody may have, you know, it's a food stamp issue. You don't yeah. know. And, you know, it may be traffic lights. It's all kinds. It may not be the hot button issue that you've heard about. There may be some other thing that takes over the evening.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one of the things that the Bloomberg administration is a little bit more disengaged
mm-hmm.
with all of the communities on all of the different matters that are out there. But, you know, he has he just has a very different managerial style. And I think under Giuliani, you had a more direct connection among the real decision makers, whereas under Bloomberg, he really does believe in management in a whole different way. And so there are more liaisons, there's more chief of staff communication, and it's just different.
How did that affect, if you were with Giuliani, were going to these town halls and you'd have the chair of planning there?
Everybody.
Yeah, so how did that, in terms of, you know, Landmarks deals with planning issues and transportation, I mean, did that impact the way the agencies work together or the agencies' understanding of one another? Did that kind of...
Well, under Giuliani, the agencies communicated directly, and there was a lot of... And I didn't even think about this because I wasn't so involved in a lot of bigger projects during a lot of the time, but a lot of land use attorneys said that they felt very confident in what they were doing because they knew that Joe Rose and Jennifer Rabb talked to each other about things and that there would be no surprises
mm-hmm.
down the road. Under Bloomberg, it went back to, I would say, probably the Dinkins or the Koch model, where each agency sort of does their own thing and they communicate,
mm-hmm.
but they're not necessarily coordinating, which is... As an architect,
yeah.
coordination is really important.
Project and management.
It's simple. When you have a project and action that needs to be reviewed by 10 different agencies,
right.
it is important that you know that they all can arrive on the same page. Because if you're going to get 10 different answers, then your project isn't going anywhere.
True.
And this is not about being chairman of Landmarks, this is about the AIA, but we've met with Deputy Mayor Goldsmith and, you know, we showed him the charts and said, this is what has to happen and this is what does happen, and he was horrified.
The charts in terms
just
of
who has to review something, and this is how review happens. And I think everybody agrees, you know, if a city like White Plains can do coordinated review, I think New York City can find a way. And it's not to reduce public input. It's really to get the ability to coordinate the pieces
mm-hmm.
of the projects together.
Are there specific examples you can think of where, you know, projects you worked on that might not have happened as easily if it weren't for that coordination?
Oh, that, from Landmarks, there was an amazing project. There was a Cass Gilbert warehouse building in the 20s or 30s, I think. And it was I loved the designation, it was a neo-Byzantine. But it was a building in the area that Joe Rose had determined should not be a residential area. They wanted to preserve as much of the manufacturing as possible.
Mm-hmm.
But here was this building that merited designation and an owner who really wanted to do a residential conversion and, you know, and was going to invest money, time, et cetera, into making this happen. So this was a building that was not really in use for anything, and he was going to do something good with it. So Jennifer and Joe had talked about it, and then Joe and I talked about it, and his executive director and I talked about it, and it had gone through all of these sort of checks and balances so that the commission could designate the building, the commission could review and approve the changes that were required, and then it could go to city planning for the special permit to allow for the use to change. Well, it got to city planning after Bloomberg was elected, and Amanda Burden was in charge, and Amanda was still operating on this, how can you make this building a residential building? So I had to, they got held up because she put a moratorium on everything that she didn't know about when she became chairman. And so this poor guy who thought he had had all his ducks in a row got held up. But it did, you know, ultimately the happy ending occurred and the building got done and it was renovated beautifully and everybody was happy. But that's exactly the kind of coordination that is really, really important to happen.
It's interesting to hear the case examples of showing the
And there are many more, but that was one of the ones that was just so sad because it had started before I was chairman. I mean, this guy had really done all his homework, but if you suddenly have the landscape shift and people are not operating in a coordinated way, then your whole thing can fall apart. So,
well, there's so many key issues in cases you worked on. The Whitney, which I don't even
know. Nobody knows about the Whitney.
So I don't know whether we should start with Whitney, whether we should jump to modernism, but do you want to dive in on the Whitney? Are you ready?
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm excited to hear this one.
So sad. The Whitney, this was when Max Anderson was the director, and there were two directors. There was a sort of artistic director for the shows and things, and then there was a managing director who ran the museum day to day. And they, with their board, had selected Rem Koolhaas as, this is the missing scheme.
This is great.
Well, they selected Rem Koolhaas as their architect for their expansion. And Rem had come up with an incredibly interesting scheme. And it was brilliant. Here's Breuer.
Yeah.
And here's all the little row houses. And the one that was a non-contributing. And here's the mansion back here. And I guess this actually goes like this. Rem had decided to approach the addition as something that started here and then grew and went over this, but it was an independent structure.
That went over the Breuer building.
Yeah. It was so brilliant and so big. It was by far the most interesting scheme that anybody could have ever come up with. And it was really like this, you know, tornado of a building because it landed in this very small footprint and it expanded and grew up.
Up and over.
But I felt, and I think, you know, the other commissioners who were looking at it on a small committee felt that for the first time it was a building, a group of buildings, and a third building. It wasn't, it didn't look like an addition to any of the historic buildings. It was a third building, which made it easy to look at from the museum perspective, harder to look at from the district perspective, because it was a new building in the district.
Mm-hmm.
So it had a different layer of review, potentially, if it had gone there.
Yeah.
But it was worth looking at it. Because there were other new buildings that had been approved in the Upper East Side Historic District, and if we looked at it that way, as opposed to an addition to the building, it changed how you parsed this whole
new
process.
Building versus addition and the different requirements.
Just your standards, you're still looking for harmonious and does not negatively affect and all those wonderful terms that you have to say in your motion. But it changed the terms of the discussion.
Huh.
In a really interesting way.
How so? Can you kind of just elaborate on that in some ways?
Well, if you're looking for a rooftop addition, you're always going to need to minimize it so that it doesn't read as, I mean, depending on what buildings you're looking at. But you, in theory, if this is the sort of major historic building on this block, how could you add something to that? It would have to be small, minimally visible, not read as overwhelming the building, et cetera, et cetera. Same thing with these. This is an intact row of row houses with commercial fronts. How are you going to add to those in a way that doesn't detract from those buildings? So if you take down the non-contributing building and you put a new building in its place that reads really as an independent structure, and Rem being smart, he got that, and he was designing this to be a truly independent piece of architecture.
Huh, wow.
And, you know, they had Arup working on the engineering. I have no clue as to how they actually thought they were going to build this thing, because it was really tough.
I'd love to see the drawings.
But the theoretical idea of this not being an addition meant that you could look at it as an independent structure, and was it an appropriate addition to the historic district? And as long as they could keep the height down, and from the longer views, it was, and that he really did design this thing so that when you were looking down Madison Avenue, you saw this little bit, but you weren't seeing it as the primary thing.
Huh.
It was one of the smartest designs I've ever seen.
Wow.
But.
I'm hearing all this, thinking, what happened?
Well, the board of the Whitney lost faith. They were totally 100% behind it aesthetically.
Mm-hmm.
I think internally things just went wrong. Max was, I don't know what was first, the board's lack of faith in the Kulhaas scheme, or Max, you know, or their lack of faith in Max, but he left. So, you know, so when your big, you know, cheerleader leaves, that's a problem. and the other part of it was they had done a real financial analysis of A, what was it going to cost to build this thing, and B, what was it going to cost to operate it?
Huh.
And they had come to the conclusion that a vertical museum was really going to cost a lot more money to operate, especially in the configuration that he had developed.
Oh, interesting.
Because he, all of the collection exhibition spaces would be on existing floors, and this building on the lower floors, because the footprint was so small, wasn't really adding to the permanent collection exhibition area. What it added was these big floors at the top for larger pieces, which they couldn't exhibit, and some additional storage and collection space, but you know, their offices were here. This would basically still be the same building,
right?
And they weren't getting as much true expansion and coordination as they felt they needed to operate more efficiently. And like everybody else, they were looking at where's the money going to come from,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. So Kohlhaas presented this to Bloomberg.
Oh, he did?
Oh, it was a brilliant presentation. And
was this a this was the committee had seen this proposal?
The Landmarks Committee had seen it, and the Landmarks Committee had decided that they could, you know, they couldn't say it would be approved,
mm-hmm,
but that it was worth having Bloomberg and the deputy mayors take a look at it, and the other commissioners, because Amanda Burden would need to look at it,
right,
and she had seen a presentation as well. But this gave the mayor an opportunity to look at it, hear from his senior advisors, and if he felt he couldn't defend it, then he could have said to the, you know, to the museum, just pull this back.
Yeah.
But it was a very exciting moment, because it was, I mean, Rem did one of the best presentations I've ever seen.
Wow.
So everything was positive, positive. Then the museum did their review and realized how expensive it was going to be, and they started to pull back. And Rem did one of the most, I was horrified. He asked for a meeting with me and the museum leaders, and he wanted me to tell them that this was the only thing that would ever get approved, and so they had to go for it.
Oh, wow.
And I went to this meeting, and I knew full well what was going on. And I don't remember if Max Anderson was at the meeting, but the other director was there, and he was furious. And I could not say, you must go forward. I just said, If the support for this building is not here from the museum side, the city's support cannot be here as well.
Mm-hmm.
This is really up to the museum to decide what they can do.
Mm.
And that was not what Rem did at all. But I felt like he had really done a heinous thing in trying to put a public servant into that position. It was the wrong thing to
do.
And it died.
Mm.
And they went back and they hired Renzo. Well, they did two things. They hired Adam, the current director, who's phenomenal, and Renzo. And that was a much happier marriage.
Mm-hmm.
And they will probably abandon the Breuer building, I think, at the end of the day, unfortunately. But they could never get what they really wanted without tearing all these buildings down.
Yeah.
I mean, as great as the Rem Koolhaas idea was, it really would not have satisfied their needs.
Mm-hmm.
So it was tough.
What an interesting conversation it must have been about just the idea of new addition too, and harmonious, and what this means, and all of those.
Oh yeah.
Terms that people struggle with. I mean,
well, but the thing of, you know, we were very lucky as. So I don't know all the real things that happened in the Whitney board meetings and all that. I only know what was presented to me. But when I was on the commission, we were coming out of the really horrible early 90s recession, which was really bad. And there was a lot of new building going on. And mm-hmm. historic districts are desirable neighborhoods.
Yeah.
And so there was a lot of new construction. And we really, I think, in the 6 years before I was appointed chairman, we really built up a good record of how to review new buildings. And I think it's, you know, it starts with the condominium building at 23rd and 6th, which had started before any of us were even on the
project.
It's, I think it's called the Caroline. And Costas Condylis was the architect, and it just wasn't getting to yes at the commission for the facade design. And they brought in Rick Cook to do the facades. And he did a terrific job.
Oh, I know the building.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so that really set a template for, you know, even though a lot of it was given because there had been negotiations and decisions made before a lot of us were on the commission, but it came to conclusion because we were able to start to define for ourselves what we were doing in terms of looking at new buildings. And that was a big, big building at the edge of a historic district, really. And then I think the next significant one was the Scholastic building in Soho, which was really fun. And really interesting, because Rossi, working with Morris Ajmi, had done a very sort of postmodern contextual design for the Broadway side, and then had done what a lot of us think was his real heart's desire on the Mercer Street side.
Yeah.
And the Mercer Street facade is so much more successful as architecture than the Broadway side.
Can you talk a bit more about that?
Well, because I think, you know, the Broadway side took, and when I say postmodern, really postmodern approach. Oversized columns, coloration. It's not, you know, it's more of that two-dimensional look.
Yeah.
And I like it very much, but it's not a cast iron building, it's not a brick building, it's a facade pasted on a building. Whereas you go to the Mercer Street side and you've got those amazing Corten frames. And it's really where, if you're looking at a cast iron facade, you can see that as a development of a cast iron facade. And it led, you know, it established the base plane, I would say, for us to review the Nouvelle building. Which,
how so?
Because we had learned, you know, you had a modern construction designed and installed on the Mercer Street facade. It wasn't fake anything, and it didn't try to look like anything. It felt like an extension of the district, an evolution of the architecture of the district. And so when the Nouvelle scheme came in, and that was really a remarkable glass design, and it related to the cast iron, it related to the large openings in a really interesting way, and it gave every commissioner around the table the sense that we had more success on the Mercer Street side because we looked at it as what would this district be like today rather than let's make it look like the district did 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Which was, it was a very different way of approaching it.
Well,
so
it
was, and harmonious.
I'm curious about that because I'm curious about standards within the commission and kind of how you build this process of what becomes appropriate new development. And even in terms of the Rossi building, I agree the facades are, I love the Mercer Street facade, even the overhang of the old.
It's beautiful.
It's wonderful. But I'm wondering too, even in terms of using words like contextualism or harmonious, looking at both facades of that building, how that led the commission to kind of, or maybe it, whether it did or didn't, just in the process of developing a commission standard for new construction. And how did it play out? How did you see one, what direction, where did the commission come from and where was it going?
I think, well, the thing that the commission prides itself on is that there is no one standard.
Mm.
It's very much, and this is every counsel to the commission will say this, it is a case-by-case basis. If it's an individual landmark, you're looking at every decision you're making within the context of that building.
Mm-hmm.
If you're looking at a historic district and the district is designated for XYZ,
yeah,
your decision has to be defensible based on that criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very beautiful building proposed for a corner in Soho by H. Stern, the jewelers. Beautiful, beautiful design. And I think they came to three hearings making modifications. And at the end of the day, I mean, Richard Alcott, who would go to the mat for good design anywhere, he finally just said, it's beautiful, but it doesn't belong in this district.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really where the standards came to. They really are defined by the neighborhood that you're looking at. So contextual can be as much about scale,
yeah,
as it is about materials. And there's a building in Tribeca, I forget, it's a corner building. I think it's east of the Holland, just east of all the Holland Tunnel rampy stuff.
A new one within the past two or three years?
Or? No, it's okay. In the last 10 years. And the commission approved, very modern, very almost cubist kind of facades. And this one woman from Tribeca who came to hearings frequently just couldn't understand why we weren't telling them to make it a brick building. And we said, you know, it fits the scale, it's a nice design, it uses industrial materials,
uh-huh,
it's not brick. But not everything in Tribeca is brick. So it's hard, but I think, you know, when you're dealing with a group of architects and planners around the table, and that is the majority of the commission at any time, you're looking at people who are looking at design in a continuum of the city and architecture and trying to make sure that it fits.
Yeah.
Because each district has its own story. And Soho has, it's got some brick buildings with little windows, but it really is, you know, designated because it took a whole new way of building.
Mm.
These were taller, not tall, but taller,
right,
than their adjacent. They had incredibly large expanses of glass. They had all this, you know, exuberant metal on the facades. And they had a very coherent kind of appearance, but they were lots of different colors and lots of different individual,
yeah,
sort of design elements, and they felt good together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we were looking for in Soho. Whereas in Tribeca, it was about height, and it was about keeping the walls. You wouldn't have a building that's set back and all this other stuff. That would just be stupid in Tribeca.
Yeah.
It was a very simple form that you could make a little bit of playful stuff going on, but it wasn't about brick or cast iron.
Mm-hmm.
It was the form and the height and the scale. So it's really, I mean, the Upper West Side, you're looking at a different kind of rhythm.
That's true.
On the Upper East Side, you're looking, that's a whole different story. The Upper East Side is a little broad in its building typologies, and so you're looking at an apartment building within the apartment building typologies and mansion buildings within that scale, and then the row houses with the commercial fronts, you're looking at that. So you've got all these different typologies that,
right,
you've got to kind of look at. And then does it fit within the typology, and then does it fit within its immediate context? Sort of go through this whole list of things.
I never thought about the two-prong for a district as big as that Upper East Side. That's interesting.
It was designated primarily for residential buildings,
mm-hmm,
but residential buildings that either had things happen to them with the retail storefronts being added on Madison.
Right.
Or apartment buildings or mansion buildings. And it actually is written that about that way in the designation report, because it's not for a single type of building.
Mm.
And that's, you know, that's an interesting thing, because when you look at the earliest historic districts, not Brooklyn Heights, but the ones that came after, like Carnegie Hill, which was two little groups of, you know, five buildings.
Yeah.
And the attempt that was made by the city at that time, which was, you know, make these two little bunches of buildings the landmarks, and we'll do preservation zoning, which allowed for 50-story buildings on Madison Avenue. Well, it didn't accomplish what they were trying to accomplish. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, you had to do Carnegie Hill. It had to be a much bigger district, which encompassed a lot of different building types, but still allowed for other things to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So